Welcome to this week's edition of our little show called Blind Like Me on ACB Radio and on Radio Reading Services, as well as Laura Ofton, also throughout the nation. We can't name any, but we're on quite a few. Our guest this week is a gentleman from, I think he said about 30 miles south of Boston, Massachusetts. His name is Frank Sawyer. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody, and thanks for having me on this program. And I hope I can give you a little bit of an idea of what I do.
Well, you have heard the show because you wrote to me, so obviously you have listened to some of our past shows, right?
Yes, I have, and I think you interview people pretty good. You always get plenty of questions, and you don't I don't have to worry about what to say.
Well, there goes your clock. I just heard it. I just heard you. You have one of the old talking times, don't you? The old calculator.
Yeah, that was the alarm was probably set for something.
Yeah, I've got one of those. They don't make those anymore, and that's a shame.
No, I think it was from the Radio Shack.
Yeah, is that where yours is from, Radio Shack?
Yeah, and the Radio Shack, they used to make a lot of good stuff, but they discontinued.
Yeah, they had a talking volt ohm meter at one time.
Yes, I got one of those, and it stopped working, and I could never find anybody to repair it.
Yeah, they don't support those anymore. Radio Shack doesn't.
Right.
Anyway, are you totally blind?
Yes. Well, I just have light perception.
Light perception. Now, how were you born this way, or how did your eye condition come about?
No, I when I was 10 years old, I had a brain tumor, malignant brain tumor.
My.
That they took out. And didn't expect me to live. But I fooled them all.
Yes, you did, didn't you?
And usually people that have brain tumors like that, within 3 years, it usually comes back again, and then it's fatal. But that didn't happen with me at all. And my doctor often said to me that if I got you a day before I operated on you, I would have saved your sight. And if it was a day after, you wouldn't be here.
Really?
So that was a blessing that.
So if I had gotten you a day before, I probably could have saved your sight. If I'd gotten you a day after, I probably would have lost you altogether.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the cancer was growing that rapidly.
Yes. Yeah.
My heavens, that's scary to think about, isn't it?
And I don't know. It's hard to say how long it was there, how long it was growing. But sometimes they say it takes, 10 years or so for it to grow.
So this began with headaches, or it began how?
Oh, yeah. With headaches. And I would lose my, equilibrium, equilibrium.
Couldn't stand up, lost your balance.
Yeah. And then I barely started losing my sight too.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, a family doctor that was taking care of me said, "Well, it's time for you to go to a sinus doctor because they thought I had sinus problems." And that doctor that we went to, the sinus doctor, he took one look at me and he said to my parents, "You get him in the hospital right away." So we didn't even go home. I went right directly to the hospital. And I don't remember too much about what happened then, but my father had said that all that night there was a parade of doctors going through my room, all looking at me.
Uh-huh.
And shaking their head and said, "No, we can't do anything for him," until one particular doctor came along and he says, "Yes, I've had good luck with brain tumors. I might be able to do something."
So they figured out pretty quick that it was a brain tumor. Didn't take them long to decide that.
No, I guess they knew right away from I think when they look in your eyes, they can tell.
Uh-huh.
By the way the retina looks in back there. But
now, if you don't mind me asking, what period of time was this? The 50s, 40s, 60s?
No, this was about 1951, I think it was.
So you were 10 years old, and but we didn't have the medical advances. Did they had X-ray then, or did they not?
Yeah, they had X-rays, and they had X-ray treatment,
mm-hmm.
Which is what I had, and is probably part of what saved me, is the X-ray treatments, because they couldn't get the whole brain tumor out, and they relied on this radiation treatment to kill the rest of it. And evidently it worked, because they said that, well, that's his only chance. And I guess at that time they gave me more X-ray treatments than anybody had ever had previously.
But they actually did a physical operation and went in there and took the tumor out, what they could take of it.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I actually had, an operation.
Yeah.
A two-part operation. And they did what they could. And
sure.
I don't, I can't remember too much of that. I don't know whether I was unconscious or what. But anyway, my father came in and said, "You lost your sight, and there's probably no chance of it coming back." And I can remember when I was in the hospital, I was in for probably 2 months or so. And one night he was visiting, and he was ready to go, and he turned off the light. And I says, when he turned it out, I said, "Gee, turn that on." And I could tell whether it was on or off.
Yeah.
But that's as far as anything progressed.
And that's as much sight as you got back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it must have been pretty traumatic for a 10-year-old. You say you don't really remember too much about it anymore.
No. Vaguely remember some parts of it. I remember that my parents were very, very supportive of it, and I think it was just about every weekday night, they came to visit me. And this was when, let's see, I was in Mass General in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we were living on the North Shore, north of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
But and now we live in south of Boston.
Yeah.
So it was probably I don't know. I don't think it was too far away for them. And they always made a trip to come in and read me stories and stuff like that. And my father was a he worked for a company called Cigarette Service.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, they used to go around servicing cigarette machines.
Okay.
And filling them up. And I think that he would be very, very surprised if he heard that nobody has any cigarette machines anymore.
No, I don't. People don't smoke anymore like they did.
Yeah.
Not,
right.
You know.
Right.
You could smoke anywhere. You smoke in the doctor's office. But those, smoke in the hospital. I've been in the hospital smoking cigarettes, but they no more. But your father had to keep working every day. And do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I had two sisters and one brother.
So your mother was having to take care of them and trying to make some time to come and see you in the hospital.
Yeah.
For 2 months. So it was pretty traumatic for them, I guess, also.
I guess she must have had to get a babysitter for.
Yeah, for the other kids. But and, up until this all happened to you, you had gone to public school, you had started school, you had begun to learn arithmetic and reading and writing, and you just started normal school like any other child. Never thought about being blind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all of a sudden.
Pardon?
I said, all of a sudden, you were totally blind.
Yeah.
And so they decided to do what? To send you to...
Perkins School for the Blind.
Yeah, one of the best.
Do you... you're familiar with that?
Oh, yeah, everybody knows about Perkins. It's one of the leading schools for the blind, education facilities for the blind anywhere.
And that was... really wasn't too far away, probably maybe 20 or 30 miles away from where we lived at that time. And let's see, I did not, think much of the idea. I did not want to go to a boarding school. I wanted to be able to come home every day to do my thing.
Well, to be with your parents and be with your brothers and sisters, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a normal child would. So not only they took your eyesight away, but they also sent you away to a school that was far away from home, didn't they?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's pretty hard on a 10-year-old kid to have all that happen to him.
Right. Yeah, it was. And I used to hate it there.
Did you?
But now that I look back on it, it was the best thing for me.
Well, it was the only thing for you. It was the only thing they could do.
Yeah.
There really weren't too many other choices back in 1951.
No.
There weren't many other choices but to send you to the school, but it was far enough away that you couldn't go home every night, because 30 miles in 1951 was a lot further than it is now.
Right. You're right.
You didn't have freeways. I mean, it would have took you an hour to do that 30-minute trip.
Yeah.
Whereas now you do it in 20 minutes.
Right.
So you stayed there every... did you go home on weekends?
Yes, I went home on weekends, and I used to just wait for Friday to come.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was so excited about going home on weekends. And the thing is that, you know, like in any school, if you get a certain amount of demerits, you have to stay for the weekend.
Oh, yeah?
And one time that happened to me, and I was just devastated that I had to stay there for the whole weekend and not get home to fool around with all my projects. And back then, I did have many little projects that I was interested
like,
in.
Like what? Like what kind of projects?
Well, fooling with cars. I had a car that I used to just tinker with to see if I could get it going, and never did much driving with it. But my brother was sighted, and he was always right with me and very supportive of me and helped me out in everything. And eventually we got so we could drive one of these. It was a Model A Ford that was the body was taken off and everything, and it was kind of high, and it was good for going up in the woods because we had about 5 acres at that time. And So my brother and I used to take rides and make roads up there, and oh, we used to have a ball. If I missed that any weekend.
But their punishment of you was making you stay over the weekend at School for the Blind instead of getting to go home. That was their method of punishing you. I'm really surprised your parents let them do that.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, since I learned that if I was a bad boy, I'd have to stay there, and I did not get too many demerits at all.
It worked.
Yeah.
It was successful. Now, you and your brother were wanting to learn how cars worked and what made the engine run. And, and that started before you lost your eyesight.
Let's see. No, I don't think so.
Oh, you think after?
Okay. It was after, yeah. That I got interested in automobiles. It seems though, like when I lost my sight, I guess I had the attitude, whatever I want to do, I'm going to do.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not going to, be held back.
Yeah.
And my parents were that way, too. They said, whatever you want to do, you can do it. We'll support you 100%. And my father, he got interested in everything that I was interested in, so he could help me out.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'll tell you what. Let's take a short break, and we want to talk about your experience at the School for the Blind, the Overbrook School for the Blind. There, just a few minutes back with more Blind Like Me. Hang on. Be right back.
Are you on the
the Blind Like Me list.
And I have made a lot of new friends on the Blind Like Me list that I'll never forget.
Well, them crazy people on that Blind Like Me list just talk about the silliest thing.
To join the Blind Like Me list, send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Okay, I love being on the Blind Like Me list because I'm the moderator, and I get to delete people if I want to.
If you enjoy chatting with other blind folks, come join us on the Blind Like Me list. Send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. As I was saying, time for On the Blind Side, the program that asks questions nobody can answer. And so with this week's On the Blind Side, here's Susie Barnes.
The Dallas Jazz Orchestra has celebrated its 30th anniversary. Among the performers accompanied by this group are Billy Eckstein, Bob Hope, Mel Torme, Doc Severinsen, and Dan Hollis, who performed as jazz pianist with the group on February 19th on the campus of SMU. Born and educated in Tennessee, his musical aptitude was recognized at an early age as a student at the Tennessee School for the Blind. As a seventh grader playing trombone, he joined the Dixielanders, a jazz group organized by older members of the school band. By his senior year, the seven piece had dwindled to three, and at that point, he joined the Nashville Musicians Local, where he began performing professionally. His contacts in this market encouraged him to pursue his college training in Memphis. In the early 60s, he was in the midst of a booming rhythm and blues market where he was able to find work supporting himself by being a sideman, a session musician as both keyboard and trombonist, and he led his own group. After graduation, he accepted a teaching position in Texas. He's performed as an active member of the famed Levy Dixieland Band, Tommy Lloyd and the Upper Dallas Jazz Orchestra, and the Swing Shift, where he and Donnie Gilliland worked and with whom he has remained friends. His professional career has spanned the decades from 1960s to the present, and in spite of time spent in customer service and technology training for survival, he has spent his life either as a music teacher or performer. You can catch Dan at the Wendell Tavern on Greenville Boulevard in Dallas on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. That's a small sketch of Dan Hollis. And I'm Susie Barnes, and this has been Blindside.
On the Blind Side, chronicling the contribution of blind people to societal evolution. Welcome back to part two, Blind Like Me. Our guest is Frank Sawyer, and when you hear Frank talk, you're going to know. I won't have to tell you where Frank is from. His accent will give him away. I guarantee you, it's Ka. It's not car, it's Ka. It's Ka talk. You sound like click and clack. Do you listen to them on NPR, those guys that do car talk? Have you heard about them?
Oh, yeah, I listen to them.
Yeah, well, you sound just like them. You have that Boston accent. So you brain tumor at age 10, and that caused your blindness, so the world became dark for the rest of your 60-plus years, and got into learning. Did they start teaching you Braille there at Overbrook School?
Pardon?
Did they start teaching you Braille?
Oh, yes. Yes, that was the first thing they started to do. And when I got sick with a tumor, I was... It was just about the end of the school year of my fifth grade class. And, of course, when I went to Perkins,
said, yeah.
Well, we're going to put you in the fifth grade. And I said, oh, but I already came out of the fifth grade. And I said, well, no, we're going to do that. That'll be the best thing for you.
Perkins Institute. I think I said, what did I said Overbrook a while ago. That's not right, is it? It's Perkins Institute that you went to?
Yeah. That's okay. In Watertown.
Yeah, all right. And so they put you in the fifth grade whether you wanted to be or there or not.
Yeah. And
well,
when I was in the fifth grade, I was out a lot. In my Braille class,
mm-hmm.
learning Braille.
Yeah.
And then at the end of that year, they said, well, we're going to have you repeat the fifth grade. I'll be in the fifth grade for 3 years.
So you're going to have to repeat the fifth grade?
Yeah.
This will be your...
They said, you were out so much learning Braille that you missed a lot of the fifth grade work that was being done.
So this will be your third year in the fifth grade.
Yeah.
Good heavens.
So the only thing I could do was agree with them.
Yeah, you didn't have a lot of choice, did you?
Yeah. And then after that, after the third year, fifth grade, I moved along to the sixth grade. And, my Braille, I learned the Braille thoroughly with my teacher, and I don't remember exactly, but I suspect it might have been a year, and I knew the Braille thoroughly,
mm-hmm.
but I never could get any speed in it. So, like right now, I could never read a Braille book for enjoyment, or I could never read, a lot of Braille.
Mm-hmm.
But I do depend on it quite a bit for notes.
Uh-huh.
Notes and labeling things, and so it was a very good thing to learn. And
yeah, sure it was. But you like me, you never could grasp it to read it very fast.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I have the same problem. There are good blind Braille readers in there. The ones of us who just can't do it. I just never could. You had the same. The same problem, but it is a useful, and I'm not advocating that they stop teaching it in school. I think it's a good thing for those who can use it.
Yeah,
but
like the first summer that I came home from Perkins, and I had some Braille books with me, and
mm-hmm.
I guess my mother had the print copy. And she used to make me read during the summer, and of course I was very, very slow. And she says, "Well, you know, if you keep on practicing, you'll get some speed." But here it is 50 years later, and I don't have that speed.
I didn't have the speed because I didn't. I hid those Braille books. When I got home in the summer, I hid them so they wouldn't find them. I stuck mine under the bed or something, so maybe nobody'd see them and they wouldn't try to make me read them, because I didn't like Braille. I didn't want to read it. It was slow. It was cumbersome. It was tiring to me. I had a lot of things I'd rather be doing than reading Braille.
Right. Yeah, that's it, I think.
But you did okay at math and geography and the rest of the subjects, a lot of the other subjects.
Reasonably good.
Yeah.
After I get out of the sixth grade and went into, junior high school, they started giving more homework, and they would give us an English class, maybe 20 pages of Braille to read a night. And I was lucky if I could get through one page. I didn't pass all the classes that first year. I think they knew that I couldn't read Braille very fast. But still, I had to do the same assignments, I found that sitting in the back of the room didn't make too much difference because the teacher would know that I was there anyway, sighted classes, I've heard. This guy that didn't want to be called on, he sat in the back of the room and sort of hid. But it didn't work with the teachers, because most of the teachers were blind too. And I would sort of bluff my way through it and get through it somehow.
I know the feeling. I did the same thing. I couldn't read Braille. I couldn't read. It would, if you started me on 20 pages of Braille now, at this time next week, I might be through five or six of them.
Yeah.
I just can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
And so if you can't do Braille, then you can't get through the blind school. So I bluffed my way through eight or nine grades, but, you know.
Yeah.
So you didn't graduate from Perkins?
No. No, that's one thing I wanted to mention, that
all
the people that I've heard you interview are have graduated, have gone to college, done everything, but I didn't even graduate high school.
I didn't either. I didn't graduate high school. I quit them in the 10th grade.
Yeah.
I quit them at the end of the ninth grade. I was quitting, and so they sent a letter home saying that they didn't want Phil to come back. But I wasn't going back anyway. They already knew that. I'd already made it abundantly clear, told them all to go to hell. I wasn't coming back.
Yeah.
I didn't want to tune pianos, and I didn't want to cane chairs, and I didn't want to make brooms. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I did know that it wasn't any of those. Not that there's anything wrong with doing any of those things. It just wasn't what I wanted to do. And of course, at that point in time, at 18 years old, I knew more than anybody in the whole world.
Oh, yeah.
I was really smart. And so I quit them. I did not graduate high school. I quit in the end of the ninth grade. Or they asked me not to come back at the end of the ninth grade, and that's as far as I went.
Well, I think that's when I got out, too. I was in Perkins until the ninth grade. Then I was so interested in automobiles at that time that I said to my father, "Gee, I want to go to a trade school where I can learn about automobiles instead of staying here." And for some reason, he agreed with me, and he didn't try to talk me out of it. And at the time, like I say, he was sort of like a salesman,
uh-huh.
and he would always be traveling around different places and spreading the word about me and where I could go to school. And after a few months, he finally said, "Well, I just can't find anything because everybody says blind. We can't teach a blind person." And so we finally found this school that was down the South Shore. It was probably, maybe 10 miles from my house. And it was called Silver Lake Regional High School.
Mm-hmm.
And at that high school, they taught automotive. That was one of the courses. And it was, I couldn't believe it, because all these other schools that my father went to, they said, "Oh, no, of course not.
We couldn't teach a blind person to work on automobiles."
And this school, Silver Lake, when he went to that, he says, the director or the principal said, "Sure, we can teach them." So that sort of surprised us an awful lot.
So there you had all the tools you needed, had an air wrench and all the spark plug wrenches and all the necessary tools to really learn what cars were, automobiles were made of and how they worked.
Right. Yeah.
So this was, how old were you? You about 16 now? 15, 16 years old now?
Let's see.
What year was this?
Maybe I was 16.
16, and you weren't doing any good in school. There wasn't any point in you going back to school. You weren't going to get any better at,
Right. I think that's maybe what my father realized. But this school was, it was 1 week. We would spend the whole week in the automotive shop, working on cars and learning about different things. And then the next week, we would spend in the classroom with related subjects, which were, the book work about automobiles, and then there was science involved and math involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other two subjects that we needed to get our diploma was English and history. And I got started there in the related class, and that was working out very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, when am I going to start to go to English and history? And the director of the school said, "Oh, we can't teach you that." So I was kind of surprised on that.
But they were teaching you about automobiles.
Right.
Did you discover to begin with that sometimes there are jobs that actually you're better off if you can't see, because you can use your hands. You don't have to get your eyes on them.
Yeah.
Yeah. You figured that out pretty quick.
And the English and history, I used to still go to those classes, and I used to participate in them, and I got Braille books.
Mm-hmm.
My father used to read a lot of stuff to me, and I did a lot of the same stuff that the kids did, that the other kids did.
Yeah.
But still, they would not recognize the fact that I was doing this stuff, and I was probably getting better marks than some of the other kids were. But so that was that was an attitude that sort of really surprised us. And basically, that's why I never got my high school diploma.
Because they wouldn't recognize the fact that you were actually doing all right in history and English.
Yeah.
But you learned a lot about automobiles, learned a lot about cars and how they worked then, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you at some point in time you quit them. Did you go to work at an automobile shop, at a mechanic shop or what?
Yeah, I did work for a while in a garage.
Uh-huh.
it didn't work out too good. Because this one garage that I worked in, I can remember this pretty clearly. I was changing a tire on a tire machine, and
we're taking the tire off the wheel and putting a new tire on that wheel.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was a tubeless tire, so.
Uh-huh.
You put something around the tire to squeeze it to the rim, and then you start putting the ear in, and all of a sudden the tire will pop up to the rim.
And stay there.
And stay there and hold the ear in.
Yeah.
And I had my fingers right, on that tire, and I was just looking at the tire to see how it would go up against the rim, and I didn't have my fingers in there when it popped up, but I guess there was somebody that was looking at me and said to the boss, "Well, if he ever got his fingers caught in there, he could sue you for all you have." And as a result, I didn't work there anymore.
Well, the same thing can happen to a sighted person.
Right.
If they got their fingers caught in there.
Right.
But he let you go after that.
I always think to myself, if I got my fingers caught in there, it would be my fault.
Yes, it would be.
Yeah. After that, I didn't get too many automotive jobs. I remember doing a few jobs at home, like doing a brake job.
Uh-huh.
And a few other things for different customers. And at that time, I was still so interested in cars that somebody put into my mind the fact that I could build a race car and have somebody drive it on a racetrack.
Uh-huh.
And I got interested in that, and I started working on called a stock car at that time. Like a stock car, I guess, is a name for a race car, I guess. Somebody gave me an old car, an old Chevy or something.
Uh-huh.
And I started doing all the things to it that you're supposed to get ready for to race it. And when I say build a stock car, actually what you're doing is unbuilding it, because you're taking every single thing out of the car that you don't need that will make the car lighter.
Sure.
Including the all the glass in the windows, the mechanism to make the windows go up, and all the seats, and all the glass except for the windshield. And then you do a few other things to it. And, at the time, I had another blind friend that actually was a blind friend that I went to Perkins with. And he is still my friend, and he lives a couple of miles from here. And we're still...
So you're still friends?
We're still friends.
And you went to Perkins School here. That's wonderful. That's yep. great. And so y'all were taking this car and stripping it down.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I was doing one by myself, and we got it to, we raced it. I actually advertised in the paper for a driver for it. And I guess that was no problem because, everybody wanted to drive a stock race car.
And you found somebody to drive it for you.
Yeah. And then I said, gee, how are we going to get this stock car to the racetrack, which was probably maybe 30 miles away?
Yeah, you need a trailer to do that with.
I said, well, I've seen a few trailers that they have down at the racetrack, and it seems like they're pretty easy to build. So I talked to my father about it a little bit, and we, discussed how we'd build one. And at the time, there happened to be a junkyard not too far from us that was it had all kinds of pipe and construction stuff. Not a junkyard for automobiles, but had all kinds of pipe in it that you could get for next to nothing.
Scrap metal, scrap iron.
Scrap metal, yeah.
Yeah, but you couldn't weld.
Pardon?
You couldn't weld.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You could?
That's when I learned how to weld.
You learned how to weld?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty amazing in and of itself. Did you put goggles on when you welded?
Oh, yes. Yep. Yeah, definitely, because like a lot of people used to say, well, what do you need? I would actually have a helmet.
Yeah, your welding helmet on.
And they would say, well, what do you need a helmet for? You can't see it anyway. And the thing is that the radiation that the welding makes is very, very dangerous for anybody's eyes, whether they're blind or not. And also, you might get splatter.
You might get sparks, or you might get splatter, sure, on your face.
Yeah.
So your father went and bought a welding rig, or you already had one, or what?
Well, we already had one. This is an electric welder. There's an electric welder and a gas welder.
Mm-hmm.
And the electric welder seemed to be the easiest one for me to use. And what it is I don't know if you're familiar with the welder, but you more or less strike an arc with it and hold that arc and move it along the metal that you want to weld.
And you melt the welding rod, and it fuses the metal together.
Yeah. And there's like the trick is that you have to hold the welding rod a certain distance from the metal, maybe a eighth inch above the metal or something like that, to continue this arc, because if it touched the metal, it would stick. And it would, it wouldn't do anything, and you'd have to pull it off. And I just happened to find, in fact, I guess my father was in on it too. we happened to find some welding rod that, like the regular welding rod had flux on the outside of it,
mm-hmm.
and it was like a hard shell, and the flux would burn at the same rate as the rod would burn, and the flux would would more or less cover up the weld, so no oxygen would get to it while you're welding, something like that. I'm not quite sure, but anyway, these rods that we got were rods with the flux that burned slower than the rod, so I could actually touch the metal with the rod, and the flux shell would be touching the metal, while the rod, you know, maybe eighth inch up inside was burning. So I didn't have to hold an arc. I could actually feel where I was, because like the welding rod is about a foot long, and you have to sort of wiggle it around a little bit as you're moving it along to stir up the pool of molten metal.
Yeah.
And you would move the rod along very, very slowly, and that flux would be burning slower than the rod, and it really worked out perfect that way, I think.
And you got to where you could tell where you were, and you could actually do this yourself.
Yes.
By yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of times, I'd weld something. If I was welding a smaller piece, I would be impatient, and I would want to see what I did.
So you'd touch it.
So I would. Well, I think a couple of times I came pretty close to touching it, and that was the wrong thing to do because it was still red hot.
Well, sure it was. You just melted it. Of course,
so
it was red hot.
What I used to like to do is weld in the wintertime. So I just take the piece and throw it outside in the snow, and it would cool off pretty quick.
And you could look at it.
And I could look at it.
That's pretty cool.
But I'd have to wear gloves and keep covered up. I did enjoy that very much, and I still have that welder, and I don't use it very much.
All right, so we're getting close to the end here. What did you work on cars most of your life, or what did you end up doing as a career?
Well, at that time, when I decided to build the stock car, I was in the process of building a stock car, and then the Commission for the Blind found me a job in a shoe factory.
Uh-huh.
And I says, wow, how am I going to build a stock car and go to work? But I did.
But
and
you did.
Also, at that time, I got, I talked to this fella that wanted me to make picnic tables for him.
Uh-huh.
I made picnic tables in, big amounts.
Uh-huh.
We used to take trail loads full of picnic tables to this guy. So all these things happened within a very short time, within a year, I'd say. And I was busy as ever.
How long did you work at the shoe factory?
Not very long. I guess it was probably 6 months.
You didn't like that. You didn't care for that job.
And I didn't like it. And plus, they said I wasn't fast enough at it. I didn't do the work fast enough.
All right, we're just about out of time. What did you end up? How did you end up making a living, or did you?
Well, with the picnic tables.
Okay.
And with getting a few jobs, fixing people's cars.
Doing odd jobs, working on cars.
And making all kinds of woodwork and things, from bookcases to cabinets to... I made hundreds of bookcases, and I still do make the bookcases.
Do you still have a wood shop?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. What's in your wood shop?
Well, I have I have a table saw,
okay.
A hand saw,
all right.
A metal lathe, a jointer, a sander, a router, two drill presses, and all kinds of small power tools. Like routers and
Drills and
Electric
screwdrivers now and
yeah.
All kinds of things like that.
Yeah, and I don't make too much money doing that now. I more or less just putter around and make places to hang up things, because just recently I. Made my shop was 24 by 30 feet,
uh-huh.
And I figured I didn't need that much room, so I divided it in half, built a partition down the middle of it, and I managed to get all my machines in one pot.
Uh-huh.
It's easier to heat, easier to go out there in the winter time, and. As far as big woodworking jobs, I think I'm done with that.
But you were able to make a living just kind of fooling around, working on a few cars and building a little woodwork, and
yeah.
And you were able to see, been able to survive all this, because I think a year younger than me. You were born 41.
Yeah.
I was born 40, so you're 63.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm a year older than you. I'm 64. Well, life has been all right. You've certainly gotten through it to this point, haven't you?
Yeah.
No point in giving up now, is there?
No. I'm, of course, I'm into computers now, and I'm just so thrilled with that, because, a computer gives me the ability to write and... listen to what I write and spell it out and everything. I'm just fascinated with that on the computer every day, as well as out in my shop.
The best thing to happen to blind people ever was the talking computer.